wish I was a mole in the ground. Wish I was a mole in the ground. 'Cause if I was a mole in the ground, I'd tear those mountains down.
Good morning. You are tuned to KBOO Portland. It's just after 9 a.m. and time for the Old Mole Variety Hour. I'm Joe Clement, your host. The Old Mole is a Monday morning radio zine coming to you from an intersectional, socialist, feminist, anti-colonial, environmentalist perspective. We offer interviews, commentaries, analyses, cultural reviews, and introspection, not only to critique the world, but to champion radically democratic, egalitarian, and earth-honoring ways of living, thinking, and organizing for a better society. The 50th anniversary of Earth Day was last week. In light of that, Michael Moore and fellow filmmaker Jeff Gibbs released a new documentary attacking the corporatization of the environmental movement and renewable energy in particular. It's come under a broad range of criticism, though, and today's Movie Moles Jan Hocken and Bill Resnick are both going to give charitable consideration to the film's own idea of its critique, but also to what the film leaves out and what, by including it, harms the environmental movement. Old Mole intern Sarah Summerhill reads an excerpt from her piece Boundaries, recently published in Washington State University Vancouver's literary magazine, the Salmon Creek Journal. This essay was inspired by her experience in a Native American literature class last summer, taught by Old Mole Desiree Helligers, which included paddling in a tribal canoe with Chinook chairman Tony Johnson. Boundaries explores how indigenous ways of knowing are vital to mending severed connections between people in a modern, technologically advanced world. We hear Jan Hocken again in today's Left in the Law with Mike Snedeker about how the coronavirus is threatening millions of prisoners and the efforts to release them. Finally, today is May the 4th, noted holiday of Star Wars fans and science fiction geeks of many stripes. Later in today's show, we're going to hear a reading by Mumia Abu-Jamal on the original Star Wars movies and the social-political context of their reception in post-Vietnam America. And after that, I'm going to nerd out with local science fiction scholar and activist Walida Imarisha. We're going to talk about Mumia's piece, which appears in a book she co-edited, Octavia's Brood. You can listen to today's show in its entirety or as shareable segments, or find past shows at kboo.fm/oldmole. Find us on Facebook or Twitter by searching for the Old Mole Variety Hour. Email us at oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com with comments, questions, ideas for the show, or to get involved yourself. Lastly, before we begin today's show, it's important to mention that KBOO Spring Membership Drive is not happening this year because of the COVID-19 crisis. That said, an anonymous donor has put up $20,000 to match, dollar for dollar, every donation and membership we get for the rest of the month. You can become a member or donate online at kboo.fm/give. Now, here are Movie Moles Jan Hocken and Bill Resnick on the controversial film released by Michael Moore and Jeff Gibbs, Planet of the Humans.
This is Jan Hocken, along with Bill Resnick, talking today about Planet of the Humans, the new documentary film directed by Jeff Gibbs and executive produced and promoted by Michael Moore. Released on Earth Day and still available to watch for free on YouTube, Planet of the Humans presents a scorched earth critique of the environmental movement. Director Gibbs places himself center stage as an environmentalist and deep thinker, probing what the film casts as the polluted waters of the climate movement itself. Gibbs interviews Bill McKibben and other climate activists in Michael Moore style, catching people off guard and tripping them up in unintended comments. Gibbs pursues his subjects to expose what he claims to be the misguided and or corrupt interests of the climate movement and its promotion of the false promises of clean energy. Much like Planet of the Apes, the film referenced by the title and its sci-fi graphics, Planet of the Humans offers a cautionary tale about human hubris and misguided faith in technology. Well, Bill, the film has had 3.8 million viewers last time I checked on YouTube since birthday, and that's a lot of viewers, and it's generated a lot of political heat and blowback. But how much light does it actually shed on the challenges of the climate movement? What's your take on first what's effective and perhaps true about inconvenient truths of the climate movement?
First, Jan, I do want to say that I think the film, whatever the intentions of the makers, is really wrong-headed in its attack on renewable energy. That's, in fact, what the major theme of it was in brief, that renewable energy is a sham, that environmentalists have been duped by the fossil fuel industry in thinking it can work. And then they move towards their solution, which is the only way to save humanity is through consumption reduction, which is, of course, partly right, but it doesn't go into who's going to have to reduce their consumption and who, in fact, needs more consumption. Lots of malnutrition in the world. And they also...
Michael Moore and Gibbs have been on the air to say that movement, they are environmentalists, they're leftists, movements need critique, we need to critique the movement, and that's been their main defense in responding to their critics.
That's, of course, right, but they don't respond to, in fact, the specifics of their argument, and they certainly responded terribly to the enormous sort of overlay on the film of population control as one of the answers, along with reducing consumption.
Yeah, it's kind of in the title that it's the planet of the humans as a whole that bears the burden of guilt around us.
That continues throughout it in one way or another, just by talking about humans in general and never talking about those humans who are making the major decisions about the way the world economy operates. There are things that they got right. You asked the right question. Do you want to get into that? And we'll just
Because I think there is this fantasy that technology, whether it's green technology or some other alternative technology, will deliver us from what people are now widely declaring a climate emergency.
Yeah, you're right about that. In fact, the people who run things are coming to rely on both greenwashing to fool people, but also that modern technology will get us out of our fix. That's a bet that I wouldn't make, but they are with our lives, of course. What else did they have right, though? They did blame capitalism, actually.
But as much as in the defense on here. Michael Moore makes that argument about the unlimited growth imperative guiding capitalism and how destructive it is in his commentary in defense of the film. But it's offset in the film by a broad machine gun approach to everyone in the movement and every proposal on the table. So the effect of that is to reduce all of the bad guys in a kind of equivalent critique. But in the mix of it, there is some focus on the industries at the helm, but not too much.
Yeah, but they also discuss that those industries at the helm have infiltrated the environmental movement, and it's a blanket denunciation of the environmental movement. They don't distinguish between some of the NGOs and movements who really are often not intentionally, but thinking they can win some reforms by negotiating with our leaders of the current system to make changes. But in any event, some of the parts of the environmental movement are, in fact, in bed with capital. Most of them, and particularly the left environmental movement that supports the New Green Deal, is not at all in bed with capital and has been radicalizing, actually, for the last few years. In fact, in the film, they bring up all of these, you know, Bill McKibben once, in fact, spoke well of biomass like 30 years ago, and they try and hang him for that, even though now he campaigns against biomass and acknowledges very freely that biomass is not part of the solution. They've spent a lot of time finding ways of discrediting. I mean, it's really sad, the amount of effort that went.
Although I don't know. I wasn't impressed with the production values. You know, part of what people love about Michael Moore films is his biting wit and working class bravado. And he's a really effective propagandist in satirizing the powerful and skewering them with his disarming, you know, wit. I mean, I think of propaganda films as advancing a very simple message where every counter-argument or contrary point is simply introduced to strengthen the main argument, which is usually a very simple one. And where he's going after the mystifications of capitalism, like a film about the sickness of the healthcare system in the U.S., which is one of his best, that propaganda style has kind of a beautiful clarifying truth. But when you go after your own movement in that same style, and it's exactly the same without Moore's wit. Everybody looks like a fool, an idiot, or corrupt, and there is no nuance or complexity. And when you take that style to go after your own movement, there are real ethical issues as well as political issues involved in being accountable to your work, your project.
This is Bill Resnick for the Old Mole. I'm talking to Old Mole Jan Hocken. We're reviewing is a nice word for we're really critiquing Michael Moore's new movie. We discussed partly what the film got right, but then also that when doing that, it sort of undermined itself and got things horribly wrong. Let's discuss some of the major things, the major points that are really wrong-headed and poorly researched and basically represent an enormous lack of knowledge of the current environmental movements.
And what you've stressed, too, is that there is no recognition of not only the Green New Deal, the gains of the environmental and climate movement, and of course it's going to be co-opted by capitalism. We live in a capitalist system, but what do you think the gains are that were not taken up in the environmental movement?
Well, first, the film contends that the left environmental movement has one major goal, to move towards sun and wind energy. And that's, of course, wrong. The whole set of left environmental movements has stood behind the Left Green New Deal, which advocates a multiple set of policies and programs to not only stop global warming, but to stop the relentless growth drive that's not just causing global warming, but undermining all the ecosystems upon which life depends.
And reproducing inequality, yeah.
Yeah, and all of the rest of it. In fact, the Green New Deal also goes way beyond them in talking about climate justice as a goal and discussing a real safety net so that people aren't so precarious and, in fact, desperate for work and also, in fact, often supporting their own industry, like the electrical workers to some extent, and certainly the coal workers.
Yeah, and I think the points you're making about while it's important to critique or honestly assess a movement and its blind spots and its failures, at the same time to acknowledge and build on the successes of movements. I mean, if all movements are failures, we might as well fold up our activist tents if we've achieved nothing. And we have achieved enormous gains over time in different movements. And I think what Michael Moore and their team works with here as a theory of change that guides this planet of the humans is that you expose and rip away a facade and expose the enormity of a problem, and that the mere exposure of the enormity and scale and depth of a problem will lead people to rise up in a radical way. But that is simply not true. I've been making documentary films now on difficult social problems for 20 years, and there is actually a body of research on that, that the approach they take in Planet of the Humans leads people to be despairing and to be skewed, misled into a view that things are hopeless and that there's nothing left to protect or to defend, that all decent and good life on the planet has been destroyed. And that's actually not true. There are areas where even the mainstream environmental movement has achieved victories over time that are now being undermined by the EPA and the Trump administration, for sure. But I think that the theory of social change that guides this film project is itself misguided.
Yeah, you know, I want to add something to your point that, in fact, the movements have had many successes. Right now, we have models of every system that's necessary to change. We can do regenerative agriculture. There are people doing it around the world and in this country. We can do energy generation by sun and wind that could be built out very quickly with off-the-shelf materials to, in fact, meet a large percent of our energy needs. We know what kinds of transportation. We have alternative transportation plans. There are some cities in the world that, in fact, are following them. There are all kinds of models that, if universalized, could make a huge dent in greenhouse gas emissions and then concentrations. And the problem is political will and the power of a very small minority over politics and the economy. And they just don't even acknowledge the possibility of all of those solutions. But I also want to talk about, I think, the major flaw of the movie, which is, I mean, we've gone through major flaws, but this one is the mother of all major flaws. They're relentless in their attack on renewable energy. And they're very proud of some brilliant insight that guides the movie, that renewable energy, the sun and wind turbines in particular, have to use coal energy, coal or nuclear energy, they don't even talk about nuclear, to build out the installations, that is. And then they jump from that, which is, of course, true. That's where most of our energy is now being produced. And then they jump from that to say, well, then it's a sham. It's, in fact, perpetrated by the fossil fuel industry. And really, renewable energy is just a child of the fossil fuel empire and will only operate to maintain their domination of energy. And that's just so wrong.
I know as a documentary myself that there you have a lot of materials available. You select interviews, you pursue some over others, you take bits and pieces to create a coherent story. And it is puzzling because Michael Moore, he's no fool, and he's been in the left, Bernie Sanders' New Deal supporter for a long time. And do you have any sense of what, I mean, we can't analyze Michael Moore, but it is puzzling that this selective picture was drawn here. And I don't know if it's worth including in what we're doing for our interview, but yeah, it's an outdated picture. It is perhaps guided by some frustration with the environmental movement and maybe overselling green alternatives, or I don't know.
Well,
do you have any sense of why they're doing this?
Yeah, I think they became, not him so much, you know, he's sort of executive producer. Gibbs is really, and this guy Zahner, who Gibbs relies on, they really created and wrote the movie, and I think now Moore is in a very uncomfortable position of having to backtrack and be seen as critiquing his actually close friend, Joey Gibbs.
Because they're no stranger to each other. And in the TV interviews, he's said that they've talked about this project for a long time. And I don't think he may have been blindsided by it, but he's certainly defending it now.
Well, he is defending it, which I think is very uncomfortable because in their defense, all they could talk about was, oh, you really have to consider an alternative set of points. But their alternative set of points are both useless. And because Moore is so well thought of, there are people who are going to think that that's a persuasive argument. It was really very dangerous. Let me just get back to the wider critique of renewable energy. They're finding that it is based on the installations have to be built with coal-fired energy is so wrong-headed. And it is because they fail to consider that the energy, the coal-fired energy that's building out the renewable system, the money is the same, at least the money and resources are the same ones that would have been used to repair and modernize and replace the aged facilities of nuclear power and coal and the big grid that they need, that renewable energy movement does not need, and needs a grid, but not the kind that the former capitalist system used. It seems to me that when really what's happening is, if we spend resources on renewable energy, we're spending less resources on reconstructing and repairing and all the rest and building a new grid of the basically fossil fuel system. And so
that's part of a transition, you mean?
What we're in fact doing is subtracting from them, even when we build out. Even when we have to use coal energy, that's a major supply right now. And they don't understand that. They seem to think it's additive, that we're both going to keep up the current system and then build all this new renewable stuff. But that's just not, in fact, what the environmental movement envisions or the Green New Deal envisions. They seem to be, I kind of understand why. But the basic notions of the environmental movement just have not been appreciated by them.
You know, Bill, I think a classic scene in the film that illustrates the point you're making is when he goes to a Earth Day concert and the performers are announcing on stage this is a solar-run concert in celebration of the Earth and protecting the Earth. And he goes backstage. And the stage crew say, yeah, well, we're running on generators now because it's cloudy and there's no more sunshine. And it becomes almost like the metaphor or the device in the film of exposing the fossil fuel infrastructure behind the facade of the sunny days of solar. And it is true that these fuels, alternatives, are so many things are tied up still in fossil fuels. The global economy is so intimately tied to fossil fuel economy. But you're describing that's what's meant by this period of transition. And it one person's transition is another person's, you know, facade. And I think that's the point they were trying to make. We're still dependent on fossil fuels.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And there are many scenes like that, like when Joe Gibbs has this gotcha movement because he went to an international fair conference for fossil fuel, for the renewable energy industry. And he asked a few of the people making the machines, well, you're making those machines using coal-fired energy. And the people look at him and say, well, yes, of course. And he thought that was this great gotcha movement. We have proved
right.
that we were making
exposing
these machines
the truth
using coal-fired energy.
At a solar panel
it's
convention.
It's absolutely irrelevant. Yeah, it's absolutely irrelevant. But that goes throughout the movie. They have this overlay of that. And we still haven't talked about, and we're not going to have time to talk about their solutions. Maybe we should say a couple sentences.
Go ahead,
for it. One of their solutions is overconsumption. Well, you have you're good at that one.
Well, there's something to that capitalism produces desires and promotes products that people wouldn't even want and need. At the same time, the form of capitalism we're living under worldwide produces tremendous austerity and hunger and many, many unfulfilled basic needs. So this idea that humanity as a whole is greedy and avaricious and over-consuming is a kind of immoral claim in my mind in neglecting just the tremendous material want and need of massive people, as well as the concentration of excessive consumption at the very top. And that's part of what people have responded to in this focus on overpopulation. You know, the heavy footprint of an affluent child born in this country versus a kid born elsewhere in the world is immeasurably different proportionately. So it's so unfair to people around the world to share this whole burden. And that itself is, I think, a propaganda strategy of the fossil fuel industries to cast it as kind of an existential problem we all share, as opposed to, no, it's not one we all equally share.
Yeah, you said it.
Including overconsumption.
Yeah, and population control by the most savage means, actually, is implied, more than implied, it's explicit in a few of the comments, as by one fellow who said, the only way we can turn this around, and I guess he's referring to how do we get back to a planet whose ecosystems are still healthy and vibrant and working to support life. The only way we can turn this around is if we have a die-off of major parts of the population. Well, who does he think is going to die off first?
Yeah.
That was really, when you heard that sentence, it was shocking. Anyway,
yeah, because that has a whole history to it that we can't fully get into here, but a very reactionary history that also has been contradicted, even at that level of women controlling and intervening in their own reproduction, that for hundreds of years since the Industrial Revolution and the claims of Thomas Malthus, people have followed this question, and where women are secure in their well-being and their material survival, they will, sometimes at their own peril, regulate their own birth rates, and sometimes in ways that are unsafe for them if they don't have access to safe means of regulating birth rates. But birth rates tend to drop in places where women are secure and know their children will survive to live. So even at that level,
healthy development is a prerequisite to creating a stable population. Anyway, this is KBOO Radio. Jan and I are signing off for the old mole. We want to remind folks that we are now in a lockdown phase. KBOO has canceled its spring membership drive, its membership donations that, in fact, keep the station alive. And we hope that you folks will want to contribute to this wonderful radio station. Jan, so
long. And continuing our radio activism, even remotely.
Yeah, yes. Thank you.
Okay.
Bye, Jan.
Okay, thanks, Bill. It was fun.
Right.
You're listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. That was the famous Imperial March, or Darth Vader theme from Star Wars. Before that, Movie Mole's Bill Resnick and Jan Hocken were reviewing the new documentary Planet of the Humans. Stay tuned to hear Mumia Abu-Jamal and Walida Emarisha talk about Star Wars, May the 4th, and science fiction. Now, Old Mole intern Sarah Summerhill reads an excerpt from her piece Boundaries, recently published in Washington State University Vancouver's literary magazine, the Salmon Creek Journal. This essay was inspired by her experience in a Native American literature class last summer, taught by Old Mole Desiree Helligers, which included paddling in a tribal canoe with Chinook Chairman Tony Johnson. Boundaries explores how indigenous ways of knowing are vital to mending severed connections between people in a modern, technologically advanced world.
Modern science encourages separation based on complexity. You might have been proud of yourself at one point for memorizing the taxonomic hierarchy, which ostensibly defines our intelligence, superiority, and claim to a life worth living. Humans are different from canines, which are different from equines, which are very different from piscines, which are maybe closer to flora, which are closer to bacteria, which aren't really anything at all until they kill you. Indigenous people have known since time immemorial that divine knowledge comes not from laboratory spaces and White Halls. This I learned sitting in front of a 36-foot tribal canoe led by Tony Johnson, chairman of the Chinook Indian Nation, fulfilling my need for a 3-credit diversity course and minded to find pieces of myself in the process. On the blue-green slicing waters of Lake River, my shoulders rose time and time again to meet my ear, the bottom half of the paddle guided by my gentle palm as I submerged it again and again into the cutting waves. The pain of paddling I never understood until that moment. It felt as if something climbed into my skin and knifed a line down my muscle, allowed fire to escape my bone marrow and begin licking me from the inside out. But soon I began to recognize my muscle fibers constricting and separating beneath my skin, flaying outwards and filling the patches with new collagen, and beginning to bend and move parallel with the fierce fire of pain, and I earned the strength for a few more strokes. Behind us, Lake River cut through a dome of all sorts of life. Evergreen trees, cypress trees, wild, light-colored green water grass, silver-shaded smolt fish swarming beneath the surface of the rippling water, flocks of birds flying overhead, and, at one point, even a solitary bald eagle. Before us, Lake River split into the Columbia. The water faded from deep turquoise to shiny gray-silver, reflected a light kind of blue from the sky so wide above us. In these moments, I wondered how anyone could think the earth is flat. The sky stretched so wide along the river, you could see it curve along the circular world. I thought of how I've looked within surface tension and seen how small things the feet of water skippers bounce inside, bump light, break within. One leg mere atoms in water that bend in tension. This I saw plunging my body, eyes open, face towards the sky, beneath water time and time again as deep as I could possibly push myself. I came to see my thoughts in front of me as electric lines, fibers of being split around water blue from the sky, delighted to see their electric sisters in the white curves of surface light. I've seen how they reach. Five new pink fingers, and grace the stretch of light to glaze inside the surface of water, not just between the body of liquid and air, but between the boundaries of life and light and the hard, bouncy region of surface tension, home only to the secrets of the universe and the feet of water skipper bugs. I understood that boundary. I understood breaking it with my fingers, first bending, then shattering, my hands still covered with water, but orange and white silver under the striking sun, while the rest of me lay beneath the surface in etched memories. I understood that these atoms, which form my skin, were once the feet of bugs, once settled in the cells between the bark and the trunk of trees, once not the rings of a planet or the celestial body itself, but the space between, minerals suspended in the atmosphere, uninterrupted in their transformation from one state of being to another. I understood the way they bonded to water, the way my skin dissolved away to release my insides to the world, where they could interact directly with light and sound and color. Underwater, I could have died and not felt any sort of human instinctual sadness. I would have understood death not as a beginning, nor an ending, but an in-between, a crossable soft boundary in which a large portion of the universe resides. I understood myself and those around me to live within a world of connections broken by dependence on technological advances. Standing in the midst of a city square, surrounded on all fours by pigeons and squirrels scampering up the sides of city skyscrapers, placeless, leafless trees planted in 4x4 plotches of dirt and bark dust, are men and women wearing ivory and rubber from head to toe, passing by with shards of metal and wire sewn to their hands and knees, moving within broken connections, dragged along by a loss of knowledge, unknowingly pressed to find it again. When I sat in a red cedar seat among the fish and the water bugs, I'd never been so far out on water without being a disruption to the waves' way. A year earlier, I'd sat cushioned at the head of a gas-guzzling motorboat paving its way across Yale Lake, disrupting any wildlife which lay beneath the surface with our liquid carbon and our deliberate speed. I ended the day with a sunburn and a headache, for the force of the motor had gotten to even I, a player in the disruption game. But in the canoe we moved slowly, 15 people brushing back only the top layer of water as we moved. The bugs in the air undisturbed by the slight peaking of paddles towards the sky, unfazed by the gentle sound of water splashing the sides, or the ripple of the mild current we created greeting nearby rock settlements and growths of water grass. At our gentlest poles, we made hardly a sound as we snuck through the cavern of trees, themselves slinking like veins across the sky above us, forming a tunnel in which only honeyed melodies of nature rang in our ears. That same canoe was carved from a fallen cedar tree in the backyard of the Pacific Northwest, dug out and smoothed with hot rocks and water, painted with hues drawn naturally from the land and blessed with each carving and stroke of paint. Christians pray prior to shoveling food in their mouth at the dinner table, but in indigenous culture there's no need to give thanks before taking a bite. The prayer has gone into each careful step of preparing food, from the morning before a hunt to the capture or picking of a berry, and on through the cycle. I leaned over the side of the black and blood-red canoe, gliding my fingers across the smolty water. I pushed, first bending the atoms out of the way, then breaking their formation tension to slide my fingers within the boundary. Water traveled up my shirt sleeve and cooled down the fire on my arm, and I welcomed it. Behind me, our skipper Tony reminded us that the canoe wanted each and every one of us to paddle together in harmony, to keep it happiest. With loss of connection comes loss of knowledge. Indigenous oral traditions rely on the knowledge of elders, those who have stood upon the higher points of the world and seen human bugs glide across water with intention, understood how our feet keep us afloat, how to teach generations through voice ways to operate upon the earth, about which corners of the universe you came from, how to move along the hanging trees and the bees. In modern society, we are expected to know things about a world we have no access to. With a few sharp taps on the screen of a bundle of glass and metal and wire, you can find what's considered a normal weight for a child, how much water a human needs to drink in a day, how long a baby is supposed to breastfeed for and when to cut it off, what sound a bird makes, how tall every mountain in the world is, and how deep every valley. You can see photos of anywhere, every man-made structure on Earth, every tree, every natural barrier, even solicits of the last uncontacted civilizations on Earth. By meeting nature at her home, out in the open world of light and color, where we belong, strings may begin to tie new connections, new beginnings. Mountains aren't measured in miles, creatures aren't categorized and civilized, and people aren't severed from each other by wires or words. When I see bees fluttering the pistils and cones of wildflowers, I think all the world lies before me. Each day pushes them to fly further apart, but I know one day, yet again, they'll come together so tightly they'll burst and become new beings. Around me now they buzz so tightly, in the legs of skippers, in the fins and minds of whales. They glide through all rivers of earth and all rivers I know nothing of. They hold up what I can't comprehend. I'm part of my body for such a long time, yet so little time at all. A part of the vortex, a part of water so much deeper.
You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. I'm Joe Clement, your host. That was the Cantina Band from Star Wars A New Hope. Before that, we heard Sarah Summerhill reading her piece about indigenous wisdom for modern technological society called Boundaries. Stay tuned to hear a two-part reading and discussion about Star Wars and the politics of culture and science fiction. Up next, in their Left in the Law segment, Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker look at the picture that is emerging of the coronavirus spreading in jails and prisons across the U.S. They discuss the lawsuits and political actions taken by prisoners themselves to address the pandemic and the growing movement for decarceration as the pandemic and public health fears bring these and other vulnerable groups out from the shadows and into more visibility.
Good morning. This is Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker, talking today about the impact of the coronavirus pandemic on prisoners in the United States. The U.S. leads the world in incarceration. With only 5% of the world's population, we have 25% of its prisoners, about 2.2 million people. We now also lead the world in COVID-19 deaths. Mike, tell us what you've learned about the pandemic and how it's affecting people and our vast system of jails and prisons, and also the potential of this crisis for what some advocates are calling decarcerating, for dramatically changing sentencing practices. So let's start with what's happening now in our jails and prisons.
Well, what's happening now, of course, in this country is always hard to know because of the patchwork of different jurisdictions and reporting and testing, but Marshall Project does a pretty good job of keeping up, and they describe essentially a J curve. That is, we've gone from 272 to 801 to 1643 to 7,000 prisoners week by week by week over this month. But that's deceptive because a lot of the huge increase in the last week has been because of testing. States like Ohio, where they had six people die in a Lisbon, Ohio facility, did widespread testing. And wherever they tested, in Tennessee and Ohio and about three other, Michigan, they find lots of people who've already got coronavirus. So it's endemic, it's happening. Correctional officers, not only are they themselves endangered, but they are the typhoid Marys of the system in that they go back and forth. They work in an environment where people are jammed in rooms the size of a ping pong table next to each other. And then they go home and they go to shopping centers. Testing is abysmal. It's just now beginning. But it's spreading throughout the prison system.
What do you make of U.S. Attorney General William Barr ordering just a few weeks ago officials running federal prisons to immediately maximize the release of prisoners to home confinement to prevent the spread of the virus?
Well, it was striking. It was sensible. And the most telling thing for me is the reaction. The Board of Prisons, the BOP, simply doesn't know how to let people out of prison. It's not what they're designed to do. And they have failed to follow up. People have litigated, even successfully, and the Board of Prisons has not let them go. There's been large-scale reluctance to comply with the Attorney General's order. So even when you get a good order from Mr. Barr, it's not, in this case, one that's being quickly or uniformly followed.
What are the legal strategies? Here in Oregon, groups of inmates have filed suits against the state and complaints for their exposure terms of incarceration, as well as being exposed to the virus through their work in laundry facilities to support state hospitals, another area of shadow labor in the economy that we might take up. But what are the legal strategies in arguing for the rights of prisoners, particularly in the face of the right-wing pushback that these are people that should serve their sentences and they're going to be a danger to the community, that kind of typical conservative backlash that you get?
Well, I'll take your points backwards. I mean, the people who are locked up are not all mad dog felons. There's 55,000 people locked up who've never been convicted of anything at all. They're simply awaiting trial. There's inmates who are 60, 70, 80 years old. There's been a consistent aging of people in state prison as the huge wave of people incarcerated in the 1990s and early 2000s are aging. There are tens of thousands of young people. There are people near the end of their sentence. There's lots of people who could be released. But legal efforts to get them out have not yet succeeded to any large extent. There have been
individuals. There are some places like in Los Angeles and some places in the country where there's been more success than other places with ACLU taking up the basis for pressuring the state to release or jurisdictions to release prisoners.
Well, usually what the judges will say, what even a relatively liberal judge in the Bay Area said, is that you've got to show that the prisons are deliberately indifferent under the Eighth Amendment and the Constitution. And if the prison officials are making some show of effort to deal with the problem and isolate people and let some people go, however weak is that effort, that'll support their efforts. That'll help them survive the Constitution. So there needs to be more political pressure, and people need to understand that there's all kinds of people. There are substantial numbers of people who can be safely released. There's been no efforts, no reports anywhere of people who have been released running amok once they get out on the streets. It should happen, and it will make a substantial difference in the number of dead people and the number of and the risk that officials and prisoners will themselves spread the coronavirus once they are released.
I mean, one effect here in Oregon and elsewhere of the crisis is to bring the voices of people who are generally in the shadows and not of much public interest and discarded in many ways in carrying out work, socially necessary work, like the Oregon State Penitentiary and the laundry work. These are people whose stories and suffering are more visible now. Of course, all of that could be gone tomorrow, as often is the case with crises in this country. Could you say a little bit about what's happening in Oregon and then perhaps turn to the potential of this crisis for alternatives to our draconian, punitive criminal justice system?
Well, there are legal efforts underway from us here in Portland, and there's a really thorough examination of this question published in Street Roots, which everybody should get a hold of. they did an excellent review of the entire Oregon prison system and fears and hopes and efforts by people all over the state to get out or to have some social distancing or to have treatment. You know, there's been shockingly little testing. There have been quarantines on death row and OSP in Salem and in other parts of Oregon State Prison because of people testing positive, both staff and prisoners. And there have been recommendations to the governor to do a large-scale release of people, of the kind of people that I talked about, for whom we know there's they have very low recidivism rates, lower than the average random male.
And she's resisted some of those pressures.
Yeah, she has. She's not doing it.
Could you give your take on the move for decarcerating? It reminds me of the move to decarbonize the economy and the level of everyday pathology that this virus is illuminating.
Well, it's a this fundamentally crazy system that has a momentum of its own. We went from 200,000 people locked up in 1980 to more than 2 million just two or three decades later. We have a huge number of people locked up, so many now that there are economic interests in people who, institutional food businesses, you know, plate steel manufacturers, all kinds of people now lobby for more prisons. It's a pathological cycle, and I'm hoping that it will break. This could contribute to that breaking. We now know that California had to release tens of thousands of prisoners for over incarceration. The population dropped from 190,000 to 120,000. And without any serious efforts or impacts in terms of increased crime, crime moves in a way that's almost entirely unrelated to how many people are incarcerated. It has to do with a larger social system.
And definitions of crime as well.
That's true. And locking people up has all sorts of bad effects socially on their families and on the system as a whole. And it's hopefully like the fact that DNA has exposed the problems with the serious felony prosecutions and made people skeptical of this caused for serious erosion and support for the death penalty. I think as people are released and it will proceed successfully, it'll save the state considerable amounts of money as prisons have become more financed than universities over the past 30 years. It has so many beneficent effects on the whole society that it's surely this, I think, is an opportunity to take the right action which would protect lives both inside and outside of prison by significant releases that in turn would support a further reduction of these crazy incarceration rates that plague the United States right now.
Yeah, well, let's continue to follow this. Whether that trajectory continues depends on what we do about it and how we organize around it. And, of course, here on KABU with our Left and Law segment as well as other reporting on the Old Mole Variety Hour, we try to bring these experiences of people from the shadows out more center stage. And we'll continue to follow this as the pandemic continues. This is Jan Hocken and Mike Snedeker talking today about the coronavirus pandemic, its effect on prisoners, and on the incarceration pandemic itself and how we confront it.
Thanks, Jan and Mike. You are listening to the Old Mole Variety Hour on KBOO Portland. We just had a conversation about prisons. We are now going to turn to a political cultural commentary from within a prison by Mumia Abu-Jamal, political activist and commentator who has been imprisoned wrongfully for almost 40 years. He records his commentaries with the help of Noel Hanrahan of Prison News. The one I'd like to share today is titled Star Wars and the American Imagination. It also appears as a contribution in the science fiction anthology Octavius Brood, Science Fiction Stories from Social Movements, that itself is co-edited by Walida Imarisha and Adrian Marie Brown. Walida joins me after Mumia's reading to talk about the piece, to talk about Octavius Brood, May the 4th, Star Wars, and the Politics of Science Fiction.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 0. It swept the nation like a fever. Lines circled blocks, and before long, it was more than a movie. It was a craze. TV commercials hawked wares emblazoned with Star Wars figures available from McDonald's. Get yours now. Before all was said and done, the movie grossed nearly $500 million. That's billions, with a B. I was, however, out of the loop. In 1977, I was in my 23rd year of life, and the targeted demographic was pre-teen and teen rather than post-teen. Besides, I was more of a Star Trek guy, and it didn't hurt that one of the stars of the Trekkie universe was a black beauty who blazed the screen like a dark, luscious comet every time she appeared. To the uninitiated, I here refer to actress Nichelle Nichols, who performed as Lieutenant Uhura of the Trek bridge crew. That said, I watched with fascination as the lines grew and other film companies tried to copy the money-making magic of the Star Wars franchise. They usually failed miserably, however. Why did Star Wars strike such a deep and jangling nerve? Why did it become a craze? One would seem to surprise everyone, critics, the movie's executives, all it seemed, except producer George Lucas. The nation had just recently been forced to submit to a seemingly uncivilized, as in low-tech, enemy, and it faced the generational rebellion of the 60s. The Vietnam syndrome permeated the culture, not just the political elites. The younger were virtually uniformly anti-war in their orientation, and a counterculture was sweeping the nation, changing dress, hairstyles, sexual mores, food consumption, and the way national minorities both were perceived and perceived themselves. In short, the land was in the midst of a cultural and political rebellion sparked, in large part, by resistance to an unpopular war. An American president, Nixon, recently resigned several months after his vice president, top aides, including the Attorney General, John Mitchell, were sent to prison, the human detritus of what would become the Watergate scandal. In this context, why would a movie, even one set in another world, find appeal when the heroes were the ragtag bunch of rebels, decidedly low-tech, fighting against a fearsome, militarily invincible empire? Part of Star Wars' success was this undeniable youth appeal, yet there must be deeper reasons for its cultural resonance. America, the Empire, didn't like its role, at least among the young. It wanted to reimagine itself as the ragtag band, fighting against great odds, against an evil empire. It imagined itself as it wanted to be, as it claimed to be in its infancy, against a cruel and despotic king of the late 18th century. It reshaped itself into the rebels, not the imperial overlords. It shaped itself as oppressed, fighting for freedom. But America, like every nation, has its ages of psychosis. It has fits of indecision and periods of self-delusion. Consider how American presidents spoke movingly of freedom from tyranny while holding personally hundreds of men, women, and children in slavery. Or imagine Jefferson, the sage of Monticello, who was the father of half black children, at the same moment as he wrote in his only book, Notes on the State of Virginia, that black people were essentially non-human, a species related to the orangutan. I mean, does this mean that he saw himself as being into bestiality? Or did this mean he really thought his children were, well, half monkey? Americans, like any people, are subject to delusions. Was this fascination with Star Wars and the national identification with the rebels one of them? For generations, Americans have declined to define themselves as imperialists. That's what our enemies called us. That wasn't what we called ourselves. We were for freedom. We were for self-determination. We were good. We were white, mostly. We were Luke Skywalker, not Darth Vader, and definitely not the cruel, warped Emperor. Yet aficionados of the Star Wars saga know that Luke and Darth were, after all, intimately related. Darth's infamous line at their lightsaber battle has become a cultural byword. I am your father, Luke. It is a measure of Lucas's genius that he scripts that moment of self-realization, of self-discovery, and of revelation. In the grisly aftermath of a war that tore millions from the face of Asia, all to cover for the corporate exploitation of Vietnam's bauxite and other natural resources, the Imperial shock trooper, the Imperial metallic death hand, was father to the rebel. they were in fact more than related. In truth, they were one. That is the meaning of Star Wars. We were rebels. We are Empire. And like all rebellious children, we were but going through a phase. We're getting ready for adulthood after we sowed a few wild oats. Once grown, we put on our imperial uniform and bow to the Empire. It is your destiny, right? Unless... from somewhere, maybe on the Enterprise, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal. These commentaries are recorded by Noel Hanrahan of Prison Radio.
That was Mumia Abu-Jamal reading Star Wars and the American Imagination, which appears as a contribution in the science fiction anthology Octavia's Brood, Science Fiction Stories from Social Justice Movements. I'm now joined over the phone by Walida Imarisha, a co-editor of that volume, to talk about it. She is an editor, an educator, a writer, a public scholar, and spoken word artist. She edited two anthologies, including Octavia's Brood and Another World is Possible. She's taught at Stanford University's Rhetoric Program, PNCA, in Portland State University's Black Studies Department, and Oregon State University's Women, Gender, and Sexuality Studies Department. For 6 years, she presented statewide as a public scholar with Oregon Humanities Conversation Project on topics such as Oregon Black History, Alternatives to Incarceration, and the History of Hip Hop. Thank you so much, Walida, for coming on The Old Mole today to nerd out about May the 4th.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
The segment we heard before this one was a reading by Mumia Abu-Jamal of an essay that's a contribution in Octavia's Brood. Could you put it in the context of Octavia's Brood and how it touches on both classic sci-fi and innovative or visionary science fiction?
Well, Octavia's Brood, Science Fiction Stories from Social Justice Movements, is an anthology I co-edited with Adrienne Marie Brown. And it is fantastical writing by artists, activists, organizers, and change makers. And so a lot of the folks we reached out to may not have written science fiction before, but we knew that they would create amazing visionary stories because the premise of Octavia's Brood is all organizing is science fiction. So every time we imagine a world without borders, without war, without prisons, that's science fiction because we haven't seen that world. But we absolutely need imaginative spaces like science fiction that allow us to throw out everything we've been told is possible and start with the question, what is the world we want, rather than the question, what is a reasonable win? And so Mumia's contribution to the collection is incredibly special and powerful and amazing, as we just heard. And I think it does part of what we hoped Octavia's Brood would do, which is sort of a two-part engagement of engaging with existing science fiction franchises and fandoms like Star Wars and allowing us to really explore the politics in it and say, how can this be relevant and useful for our movements for justice? And then Octavia's Brood also wants to create spaces for us to come together collectively to imagine new worlds from the bottom up rather than engaging with someone else's vision of the future. So we're hoping to do both.
A number of the stories and pieces in Octavia's Brood touch on crises and dystopia. Which ones do you think speak most to our moment right now?
There are so many, and I think it's really important to immerse ourselves in what I call visionary fiction, which is fantastical art that helps us to imagine how to build new just worlds. It's important to recognize that's not utopian, because oftentimes the reality of the work that we need to do to build the liberated futures we want, it's going to be hard. It's going to involve sometimes things getting worse, sometimes much worse, as we're seeing in this current crisis. But it's important to recognize that we can always make it better, and we can always build the world we want as we're engaging in collective action and collective struggle and rooting in the principles and values that we have. And so, you know, there are a number of stories in Octavia's Brood that deal with things getting worse, From Children Who Fly, which is by Leah Lakshmi Pyapsnasamara Sinha, which takes place in the flooded remains of San Francisco and in the Bay Area, and imagines a ecological crisis that has really devastated the world. And yet it is the children of folks who are engaged in organizing work today who are coming together, and through their own experiences as survivors of trauma and abuse, are able to come together and heal the entire world. And it's stories like that that I think highlight how important imagination is and how important a space for emotion is. Because an understanding that those of us who have been victimized, we are not broken, we actually then have the powers to heal the world, it fundamentally changes how we think about our organizing work today. And so I think that's one of the many gifts of visionary fiction or radical science fiction.
That emotionally inclusive and intelligent way of writing science fiction is a feature of Octavia Butler's work itself. Could you speak to how she became the namesake of this volume and how she is the mother of this brood?
Yeah, Octavia's Brood is named in honor of Octavia E. Butler. The title is a play on Octavia's trilogy called Lilith's Brood. And for us, we really think of ourselves, hopefully, in lineage with Octavia. We are sure that we're probably doing things differently than how she would do it, but we hope that she sees the DNA of her writing, of her visioning, of her important social critique that came through her science fiction work in the work that we're doing. And for many of us, that is the first place that we sort of saw an intersection between, a clear intersection between organizing and science fiction, and really saw what it means to center folks of color, women of color, women of color with disabilities, queer women of color with disabilities, all of those different identities, and what it means to have a different relationship with power, what it means to talk about collectively sharing power rather than building hierarchy. And so I think Octavia E. Butler's lessons are so prescient and so important for us today. She is one of the many voices that is key to being able to imagine things differently than they are.
We'll have to have you back on to do a focus on Octavia or one of her works. Before we go, I'd like to zoom back out to the theme of the day, May the 4th and Star Wars, and ask you to engage a bit more with Mumia's piece and how you identify as a Star Wars fan.
Sure. The essay that Mumia read began when I wrote to Mumia and told him we were creating Octavia's Brood, and he just wrote back this beautiful, almost fully formed piece about the power of science fiction, specifically through Star Wars, and I wrote back and said, can we print this? Because I think it's so important to reflect on these franchises and fandoms that have shaped all of us, and to think about what is the political messaging that was intended, what is the political messaging each of us got out of it, and what is the political messaging that has been put upon it. And all of those can be the same or very different. And so Mumia's exploration of the concept of empire and the idea of rebellion is always important, but especially in these times, to say, what does it mean if we want to be part of the rebel forces? And I have yet to meet anyone who wants to be part of the empire. If you meet someone who wants to be part of the empire, you should get away from them. But what does it mean to be part of the rebel forces on the ground in this day and age? It means standing against empire, and it means collectively organizing and mobilizing on the ground with the leadership of those who are most affected. And so how do we reimagine our work in that light?
It's such a quintessential American fantasy, isn't it? You go back to the origins of this country, which are shrouded in revolutionary rhetoric against the empire, and you fast forward to today, and you have armed so-called protesters of the lockdown situation rebelling against public health measures for the sake of the economy. There are so many contradictory things bound up in this signifier of the rebel.
it's incredibly important to ask the question, what is being rebelled against? And also, what is being fought for? That question is incredibly important for our movement. That, as a Star Wars fan, has been interesting to see with the finalization of this last trilogy, to really see that in Star Wars, we are fighting against the Empire, and that's very clear, and that's important. But we don't often get a vision of what we are fighting for. And I think that that is part of why it is something that draws in a larger American public. Because I think if we extend that out and say, if we're against an evil empire, what are we for? Well, then we're for communal, collective, mutual aid societies that, you know, are cooperative and make sure everyone's basic needs are met. Then folks have to ask themselves uncomfortable questions about what that actually means on the ground and their own feelings toward that. In some ways, I appreciate Star Wars because I appreciate an unquestioning anti-fascist commitment, which I think to me is what I take away from Star Wars, that there can never be any compromise with empire and with fascism, that it must be fought at every level. But I think the thing that we have to be building, and this is why we need our own imaginative spaces, we have to be offering visions of what we want, not just fighting against what we don't want.
Such a good note to end on. Thank you, Walida Imarisha, for coming on The Old Mole today to talk about Star Wars and the politics of science fiction.
Yeah, thank you for having me, and thanks for letting me nerd out.
Well, that's all the time we have for today's Old Mole Variety Hour. I'd like to thank our contributors, Bill Resnick and Jan Hocken, for their critique of the controversial film Planet of the Humans. Thanks to Old Mole intern Sarah Summerhill for reading an excerpt of her piece Boundaries about Indigenous Wisdom in Modern Technologically Advanced Society. Thanks to Jan Hocken again and Mike Snedeker for their discussion of the coronavirus crisis in the prisons and what people are trying to do about them. Thanks to Mumia Abu-Jamal for sharing his perspective and wisdom on the role and power of science fiction in our imperialist society. And thanks to Walida Imarisha for carrying on the discussion that started for us and talking about Octavia's Brood, May the 4th, and the politics of science fiction. And thanks to Denise Morris, Patricia Kohlberg, and John Nilsson for their pre- and post-production editing. You can find The Old Mole in a day or two by going to kboo.fm/oldmole. You can reach out to us on Facebook or Twitter by looking for The Old Mole Variety Hour, or email us at oldmolevarietyhour@gmail.com. Tune in next week for more news, reviews, and interviews from The Old Mole's radical perspective. Thanks to the KABU staff for keeping this system going. And don't forget that KABU is not having a membership drive this spring, but we are having a matching period this month where if you donate money, it will be doubled. kboo.fm/give. May the 4th be with you.